everybody. This is Christy Slobogan. Before we start this episode in earnest, I wanted to say thank you so much for listening to this first season of In the Same Vein. Now, this is the last episode of our season, but please do continue to listen to and share all of our episodes from this first season. We'll have another season coming out next fall in 2025, so please do make sure that you're subscribed on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify so that you know exactly when our next episodes are dropping. Now, I am not the co-host for this episode. My wonderful colleague, Dr. Jonathan Harrington, will be taking over for me for this final episode of season one. You may remember him from episode 5 of season one, the last episode where he served as our guest. And you may also remember that he spoke about his work in AI and large language models in medicine. So he's using that expertise to interview Dr. Erica Ramsdale this episode. I will now hand it over to them. But again, thank you so much for listening to In the Same Vein.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Harrington, an assistant professor in the Health Humanities and Bioethics Department at the University of Rochester.
And I am Adam DiDabalere. I'm a PhD student in philosophy at the University of Rochester.
Today, we're talking to Erica Ramsdale, who is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology and Oncology at the University of Rochester Medical Center and at the Wilmot Cancer Institute. She is a dual-trained clinician in geriatric medicine and medical oncology and completed a fellowship in clinical medical ethics at the McLean Center at the University of Chicago. She has a clinical practice seeing patients older than 70 with gastrointestinal malignancies and is an NIH-funded researcher in cancer and aging, including using AI and machine learning methods to understand outcomes in older adults with cancer. Alongside all of that, she has a master's in data science from University of Rochester, and she co-leads a team of software engineers developing and maintaining Hyperion, a data and application platform which bundles curated, multimodal data with analytic tools for clinic, research, and operational needs of the cancer center. So she is a perfect person today to talk about the topic that we're interested in.
In today's episode, we talk about the use of large language models in medicine. We discuss bias in AI, the risk of automating diagnoses, and the state of data quality and privacy in medicine.
I was really excited about today's conversation. I've had a lot of discussions with Erica over the past year about the ethics of AI in medicine and about her training as a data scientist and a clinician and the importance of interdisciplinary work, which is something that's pretty close to my heart.
Yeah, before coming back to academia, I worked for a couple of different healthcare technology companies where I focused on both AI ethics and health equity. And hearing from clinicians like Erica, who are working with both patients and AI tools and on the software development front, is always a really enriching experience.
So Erica has a really interesting perspective on the use of large language models in medicine, and we hope that you enjoy the conversation.
Hi, Erica. Thanks for joining us today. To prepare for this podcast, we read an article, Large Language Models in Medicine, The Promise and Pitfalls. Could you just give us a summary of large language models and their possible application to medicine for our listeners so that we're all on the same page?
Yeah, great. And thank you. I'm so happy to be here. This is a fascinating topic. And this was a great paper. I think a very accessible introduction for people even who aren't well-versed in AI jargon, and kind of covers some of the things that we might want to think about in applying these models to medicine. So a great overview. I encourage everyone to read it. So large language models are essentially algorithms that can take in large amounts of data and then actually generate new data, new text data specifically. If you're talking about language models, they can take in and generate language. So these were developed over the last decade or so based on a new sort of neural network architecture, which the paper goes over a little bit. I'm not going to get too much into the technical algorithm, but these algorithms can do kind of some neat things in how they process language that makes them a little more similar to how we think humans process language and how we pay attention to meaning and sequencing and pulling the important bits out of, you know, a block of text. So these models are really able to do that a lot better than prior language models. And then going beyond language models, we now have newer models that can not just take in language and generate language, but also take in what we call multimodal data. So data from a bunch of different sources, whether it's video, audio, text, you know, any data format that might be relevant, including in medicine. These models can now take that in and generate those data formats as well. So it's really moved beyond large language models. You know, I've heard the term large multimodal models, foundation models, which is mentioned in the paper, is also sort of all-encompassing. So that's what they are. And then in terms of applications to medicine, wow, that's really broad. Right now, at least the things that I'm aware of in current use are kind of tools that help us manage and curate the overwhelming amounts of information that we use in our daily lives as clinicians. So that could include things like listening to clinic visits, like AI scribes, and then generating the note. It could include things like summarizing patient records and trying to pull the relevant information forward. So a lot of it is knowledge curation, which I find a really interesting aspect of AI in terms of its medical applications. But you can also think, I think the things that are coming are things like diagnostics and prognostics related tools. You know, AI is also, you know, already used for things like drug development and sort of personalized medicine. But I think at some point we're going to be seeing those decision tools migrate into the clinic, so that clinicians are interacting directly with these tools and using them to diagnose, to make decisions, to determine prognosis, things like that.
So, you know, given all those different uses that we might have for large language models in medicine, what do you think are the biggest benefits of large language models in this context, and also the biggest ethical risks?
Yeah, it's also a very big question. I think that could take up the whole hour probably of the podcast. But, you know, I think, again, the opportunity I'm most excited about is helping us get a handle on the data and sort of knowledge curation and bringing forward what's relevant. You know, me as a clinician, if I have 30 minutes to see a patient and I'm trying to wrangle all this data from many different sources and read through a bunch of documentation, most of which is not relevant, you know, AI really becomes an extender for me in terms of efficiency and maybe in terms of decisional sort of ability, if I have the right information in front of me while I'm making the decision. I'm a little more wary of tools that take that decisional agency out of the physician's hands, you know, in terms of the machine telling you, here's the information and here's what I decided about it. That's sort of the next step. And I think that's a risk for several reasons. But I think there's a risk that, A of all, the algorithm is making the wrong decision or doesn't have complete information. We can't exactly go like look under the hood of the model very easily and tell how it's making its decision. I mean, that those are things that might evolve over time, that ability to really interrogate the model. So we don't know if it's making the right decisions. We don't know what it's making the decisions based on. And these models often state things extremely confidently if you've interacted with them. And I think humans are just sort of primed. You know, something's stated at them very confidently. There's sort of an anthropomorphic sense of like, oh, this is just a person talking to me very confidently. It must be true. And it's not something I think we do consciously or because we're stupid, or not critically thinking. I just think it's kind of hardwired. So I worry about, you know, sort of yielding our agency to these models. But I think in terms of helping us extend our time and our efficiency and our knowledge and really help us curate, I think that's a real advantage.
Yeah. So this phenomenon that you're talking about where these machines can say something really confidently, but it can still be false information. They might, tell you something and it really seems like good advice, but it might actually not. But we're sort of hardwired to just sort of believe when people are speaking confidently. This is often talked about as a phenomenon called automation bias. So like the best example of this is when your phone or like Word or something like that spell checks you, you don't go open up a dictionary to go check if spell check got it right. You just trust the automation. So with regards to LLMs in medicine, how do you think that we can mitigate the risk of automation bias? What domains do you think we should be most worried about automation bias, and how can we best stop it from hurting us?
Yeah, I think the best way to mitigate it is, you know, we say in medicine, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? You have to think upfront how you're deploying these models very carefully before you actually do it. And that's going to be really tricky because these models have a hold on many fields right now and on the imagination of the public, and AI is going to come in and help us be better doctors, and they're master diagnosticians, and they're, you know, there's a lot of money to be made. So the inclination, I think, is unfortunately not to slow down and sort of think about the implications. But my answer is exactly that. We need to sort of slow down, you know, map out what we think the risks are for each use of these tools and try to think through that and then build in some mechanisms. I mean, that might vary by the use case that we're doing. So in terms of, say, efficiency, so I will acknowledge I use things like ChatGPT to create insurance approval letters. Saves me tons of time. And so I say, you know, I don't give PHI to the model. Don't do that. You know, if any data is going to any of these other servers, but I'll give a general sense of the situation and fill in the details on my side. So what I've noticed is they do a pretty good job these days of getting the right background to, you know, what's the disease, what's the indication for the medication. It'll list citations, but it's incumbent on me to go make sure those citations are real, that they actually reflect reality, that they're actually about what I'm trying to write about. So these things save me time, and that I don't have to sit in front of a Word document and like think through every word. It sort of cognitively offloads me a bit. But it's still really incumbent on me to go check those sources out. I cannot treat it like spell check, where I just assume that it knows what it's doing, at least not at this point. So for efficiency, I think you just got to go check what it's saying and make sure it's real. But it could still save you time and maybe significant time. I think the danger is really in using these for sort of prognosis, diagnosis, things like that, that really have real and potentially immediate and potentially serious effects on the patient if the model's getting it wrong and we just believe it without interrogating it. We know that doctors do this without AI. You know, we know that humans do this. They get really settled on an answer and then they don't move off that answer. So there was a really interesting study, I think recently it was reported, I think in the New York Times, where they had this experiment with three groups of doctors. One that was making diagnoses off a standard set of cases on their own, one in conjunction with ChatGPT, and the third was ChatGPT alone. And at least in these standardized cases, ChatGPT was better at diagnosing than the human by quite a big percentage. But what was interesting is the doctor and the doctor plus GPT did the same. I think they got about 75% accuracy, and the model alone got about 90%, if I'm recalling. And so the interesting thing, they went back and looked at the transcripts. And the interesting thing was the doctor that was interacting with the model would try to move them onto a different answer. But the doctors themselves were so stuck on the answer that they couldn't sort of think their way out of that, even with the models nudging. So this is kind of the opposite of what we're talking about, you know. This is a case where they didn't let the models, they were a little too skeptical or stuck. But I think it's a tendency as humans that we have to just be really aware of when we're interacting with these, that we have confirmation bias. We have all kinds of bias in terms of how we think of information and make decisions. And then the model's adding this whole other layer of complexity to it. So how do we mitigate that? Again, I think it's before we implement these tools, we need to think through what are the risks if the model gets it wrong, or what are the risks if the model gets it right and the human's not listening, or, you know, there's all these possibilities, and really thinking through them carefully and taking our time, I think, is the best mitigation strategy.
Erica, you mentioned something in your answer there, PHI. Can you just tell our listeners what PHI refers to and why it's a concern with large language models?
Yes, I used an acronym, didn't I? So that's essentially identifiable health information. So anything that could allow you to be identified on an individual level and that's protected under our laws and federal regulations, that's what I mean by PHI. So anything that the model could use to identify you as an individual person. So we're talking about privacy. And a lot of these companies are sort of claiming we're not going to use this this information for training. But I think it's important to have skepticism and always keep privacy front of mind, you know, respect for our patients, and make sure that we're not sending any data into the ether where we don't know how it might be used.
Yeah, and that question about, you know, where the data ends up, I think is really relevant to one of the use cases that has been really hyped up recently, which is, could patients directly interact with these models, right? You know, should patients be able to use large language models to access their medical records in more useful ways in patient portals, or generate summaries of their care? What do you think about that practice of letting patients directly interface with these large language models?
I think the hope is that AI models will democratize access to information and data. So from that level, I actually encourage it. I don't think we should, you know, be a nanny state about how these should be used. You know, only the doctors get to sort of use these tools on information. I think ideally, they should be tools that really democratize access and understanding. That being said, I feel like using AI in this setting to generate summaries or access records, it's a little bit of a band-aid on a bigger problem. Like, the bigger problem, as I see it, is we don't give patients good ownership of their data. We don't have data interoperability across systems. So, you know, often people are seeking care across multiple doctors or multiple systems, and they simply can't get their records in one place. This is a big problem. It has nothing to do with AI per se. But what if we envisioned a whole workflow where patients own their data, where this was really centered in the patient? They own it. The system doesn't own it. This is technically feasible without invoking AI whatsoever. You know, we could give patients access right now. Well, with some build, with some infrastructure, we could give them access to their data along with the tools to understand it by writing it in plain language, you know, interpreting it, summarizing it. You know, the tools that we have for data documentation in healthcare aren't working for anyone, but potentially the billing systems and the revenue capture. And so that's where all of the documentation is centered. And I think that's a big problem, that just slapping an AI on top of it and saying, go interpret all this, you know, nonsense and pull the pearls out of it. I think that's an unnecessarily risky approach. So am I opposed to it? No. Like, I would never tell anyone you shouldn't have access to new technological tools. I want everyone to learn how to use them and use them, in, you know, well. But I think there's also a better approach in terms of patient data that I don't want to just neglect to address.
Speaking of patient data quality, why does data quality vary so much? Why are there so many different approaches to medical data? And how do you think this is going to affect the development of large language models that are being trained on this messy medical data that we've got right now? How do you think we can mitigate any risks there? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is going to open up a whole can of worms for me, because I think about this all the time. A big part of my job is on a team of software developers and engineers that have developed and maintain a data platform. You know, it's a federated data platform. I think it's up to 150 or so different data sources, most of which are coming in real time. And when we designed this, these models weren't available. They were maybe on the horizon or maybe a glimmer. But fortunately, we designed this platform in a way that AI can leverage the data that we're collecting and that we've organized. But in general, I think the cart gets put way in front of the horse in terms of AI models, and we don't necessarily have the data to do justice to building these tools. And what I mean by that is it's really garbage in, garbage out. So if you're not paying a lot of attention to the data and how it's structured and how it's processed and what assumptions you're making as you're assembling your data set, you know, in data science, we say like, you know, 90, 99% of the work is assembling and cleaning and wrangling the data. And that's very true. So the actually implementing the AI model, as counterintuitive as that might seem, is almost the easiest part. Because if you have the data right, there's a lot you can do and feel better about when you're training these models. But the risk is if you put low quality data into these models, you're going to get nonsense out. You're not going to know why or how you're getting nonsense out based on how complex these models are. And so you really got to spend a lot of time thinking about data quality. And so why is data quality poor? That's also probably a dissertation. But you think you have all these systems that aren't talking to each other. You know, you have a lot of still human data entry, which has a pretty high error rate, you know, especially when you're duplicating data across systems, which is very common. We talked about care fragmentation. So again, multiple different systems housing multiple different data sets that may be discordant. We see that all the time in the data sets we assemble. So there's a lot of ways that data can be what we call noisy or have a lot of junk in there. And I worry that we don't talk enough about data management, data governance, data quality. You know, it's this whole iceberg that we sort of ignore. And I use the analogy a lot of like, it seems like you just sort of shake the EHR like a salt shaker and knowledge falls out, you know? But data is not information, is not knowledge, is not wisdom. I think that's really important to keep in mind. So I think we ignore that to our peril, and we're going to get bad information if we put in bad data. So we need a lot more infrastructure, thoughtfulness, technical expertise in thinking through healthcare data, which by some estimates is like 30 or 40% of all the data in the world. But we have something like 3% of data scientists, trained people working within healthcare. And so we need to change that, and we need to build infrastructure.
Yeah, I think that really resonates with a lot of the thinking I've been doing lately. So, you know, when people talk about the ethics of AI and medicine, they're often very focused on questions like privacy, like bias, like how this is going to change the therapeutic relationship between clinicians and patients. And those are all really important. But for me, like foundationally, some of the biggest ethical questions are about what is the data that we're putting into these systems? Do they actually do what they say they're going to do on the tin, right? And I think we often lose sight of the ethical imperative to create strong systems and structures that give us good data that help these kinds of systems perform well.
Yeah, 100%. Data is also created, maintained, interpreted by humans. And this may fly in the face of how scientists usually think. In fact, I know it does, but data and knowledge is just not some, to me, some objective thing that's out there that's separate from human understanding and meaning. And so this is raising, to me, very interesting questions about what it means to understand data in the era of AI, because I tend to be a very firm believer that the human matters in terms of interpreting and contextualizing these data. And I don't know what it means to sort of take that out of the hands of the human and sort of give that to the AI, because I don't think it's this objective reality. And maybe that puts me in opposition to a lot of scientists. How we're trained is there is a truth that's objective, and we can get to it by doing experiments. As I'm thinking more and more about that, I just see the ways in which our decisions really contextualize that data. You know, what we decide to include in our data sets and how we decide to process that. There's no such thing as just reality that we're ingesting into our systems. We're transforming it into data in some way. And do we understand the implications of how we're doing that? And thinking about the data platform that we have, you know, I think very consciously, or I try to, about what are we including and what are we excluding? And how are we processing the data and how might that interact with how we're making decisions with it? But a lot of this tends to be relatively invisible. You know, if data management's working well, it's kind of invisible, ideally. But that means it's not as transparent maybe as it should be, and it's not thought about as much in the race and the hype to implement these AI tools. That's the shiny object, and I worry about that a lot.
So speaking of these risks of, you know, the difficulty of data accessibility, the technical and legal challenges that come in when you're trying to synthesize medical data, some developers who are creating these machine learning and large language model tools for medicine are solving that issue by creating synthetic medical data. So they will sort of use something like a large language model or their own statistical methods to generate kind of fake patient data. So it's not coming from the EHR, it's just sort of entirely made up data. And then they can use that data to train new models, to build stronger machine learning algorithms, stronger risk scores, that kind of a thing. How do you think we can balance the potential benefits of using synthetic medical data, like addressing data scarcity and promoting diversity in research, with concerns about data quality and reliability?
Yes, I have some big feelings about synthetic data. I do think it has its place. You know, this has been used in other fields, I think, for a long time. Things like automated vehicles or, you know, airplane safety. Things where you're looking at mechanical systems that can be simulated, right? You can run simulations and sort of understand what might happen with an airplane and detect problems and be able to fix them before they actually happen in the real world. So this is kind of an incredibly powerful concept in some sense. And I think in medicine, it does have some power in some situations. For example, going back to privacy. You know, there's a way to sort of preserve a lot of the structure and meaning of the data in terms of statistical distributions, like how the population overall looks, but scramble the data enough that you maintain privacy. You can still get conclusions. You know, you can still infer things from the data in the same way, potentially, but you're sort of masking the individual patient and protecting their privacy. So I think synthetic data for privacy is really compelling. Or if you're trying to sort of make population level understanding or simulate a large group of people, I think it probably has a lot of power there. I worry about two of the things you sort of mentioned, or two use cases. One is data scarcity, sort of creating new examples of rare or scarce or underrepresented data. You know, that's really close or similar to what's called oversampling. You know, if you have a group of data points and, you know, one is, you know, there's a majority that are all in one category. Let's say you've got a patient data set and most of the patients are white. And then you have a small percentage that are Black and a small percentage that are Hispanic, small percentage of other racial and ethnic groups. You might want to say, oh, well, for sort of diversity, health equity reasons, you know, we want to balance those data sets. We don't want the whole data set to really be reflective or weighted on only white patients, for example. Good goal. So you might want to say, well, we'll oversample, we'll sort of not quite clone, but we'll sort of simulate a new patient using what we know about the smaller group of, say, Black patients. Okay, so that's oversampling. The problem is we don't know whether that small group that's in our data set is actually representative of that population. So the oversampling is not going to make up data that's sort of outside the distribution of what we see. And so if that population isn't representative to begin with, which it's not likely to be, then you're just compounding the biases because you're just creating more of the ungeneralizable data and then drawing conclusions from that. So that bothers me. I'm sure there's ways that people are going to come up with to mitigate, assess, measure that. And it could still be good for some cases, but I think that's a significant problem. And then where I really get nervous is when you're talking about individual level simulation. I mean, maybe we're simulations of someone else running. That's a whole other topic that I sometimes freak myself out about. But I think what's coming and what people are interested in is this idea of a digital twin, which is you simulated in digital space and can sort of forecast things. This is the notion, right? It can forecast things about you. It can help you make better decisions. Oh, gosh, this sort of terrifies me, because even if you're getting all this granular data, like we have all these things and ways to get granular health data, that's very true. And maybe it can help us decide that we need to see our cardiologist or whatever, you know, it can kind of give us some hints about what we might do. I get really nervous about making decisions, big decisions in particular, about the direction of our life based on digital twins. I don't think people are reducible, no matter how much data we collect from them and try to simulate them. And this is my belief, but I believe there's something irreducible there. And that makes me very nervous. And then going back to what we were saying about sort of automation bias or people kind of getting anchored in what the model's telling them. And people don't like to believe this, but we're very emotional in our decision-making. We're not these creatures of logic. And we already don't manipulate statistical information very well to make decisions. Doesn't matter. Like, I'm highly trained in this. You know, I deal with statistics and I'm still just as bad as anyone else at knowing what I should be scared about. You know, I'm still scared every time I get on a plane, but I'm not scared when I drive to work. There's, you know, we're not able to really understand, you know, it's very sort of intuitive or an emotional feel when we're interpreting risk. And with digital twins, what's going to happen when we start spitting out predictions and probabilities? You know, they're not going to probably tell you this is 100%, you know, it's not a crystal ball, but it might say you have a 60% chance of this happening to you based on your digital twin and the simulations that are going on based on your data. What do I do with that? Is that helpful? Is that going to, you know, create a lot of distress? Is it an anxiety? Is it actually going to help me make better decisions than I would otherwise? I am very dubious about this. So I think some promising uses in terms of patient privacy and maybe understanding population level things. I'm nervous about synthetic data otherwise.
That's really helpful. So the article also notes that these large language models frequently reinforce structural biases found in the training data. For example, certain large language models exhibited racial bias when asked to provide analgesia choices, so pain management choices for chest pain, resulting in weaker recommendations for Black patients than white patients. It's something that's discussed in the article. And it seems like you're a little bit skeptical of the use of synthetic data to help us manage those structural biases. Do you think that there are other ways that we can deal with those sorts of worries about bias in these large language models? Or are we sort of doomed to repeat the kind of structural inequities that we see in healthcare?
Doomed, I don't think so. And I should say I'm not an expert in all the ways, of course, that people use synthetic data. And there's some pretty sophisticated mathematical techniques that people are using, and I don't pretend to understand them. So my nervousness could be shifted once I see how some of these things are working in the medical space. Like I said, I think it's brilliant for understanding how an autonomous vehicle might behave in sort of situations that you can't really simulate in the real world without some damage. But I just get nervous about the irreducibility of humans and humanity. But I know there's a lot of statistical techniques to try and mitigate bias and investigate and quantify bias. And there's, you know, simulations you can run and sensitivity analyses you can do with different permutations of the data to try to understand how the outcomes might differ depending on what's encoded in the data. So I definitely think that's worthwhile, whether it is with synthetic data or without it. we need to be doing those analyses, those sensitivity analyses, and running simulations to understand how the impacts might be, you know, unfair or biased. That requires, you know, again, a human in the loop thinking about these things. It requires us to constantly be tweaking and training and interrogating our models, not just winding them up and letting them go. And so I don't think there's a perfect answer there. And there's also trade-offs. So when you start adjusting for sources of bias or what you think are the sources of bias, you know, quote unquote, accuracy or performance of the model can go down in some cases. And many times we're trying to maximize the performance, the predictive performance, say, on a data set. And often when we're going back and sort of adjusting for bias, there's a tension there. So I think we have to be very intentional about what we want to prioritize in terms of how we want the model to behave. And we need to constantly go back and sort of reinforce it, interrogate it, make sure we understand how it's working and what the impacts are on the humans.
Yeah. And thinking about how, what the impacts might be on humans, what the impacts might be on the industry as a whole, I'm going to ask both the predictive and the normative question here. So the predictive one is, how do you think that AI will change the job of medical practitioners? And then the normative, how do you think that AI should change the job of medical practitioners?
Whew, prediction. I tell my patients this all the time. I have no crystal ball. So maybe I can make some short-term predictions at least. I mean, I think the knowledge curation tools are already being implemented. You know, they're coming. I'm talking about AI scribes, tools that can help us with documentation, tools that can help us sort of wrangle all the information and maybe provide some gloss of interpretation. Those tools are already here in an immediate, imminent development. You know, we're working with some of those tools on our team to help interrogate our data. And, you know, we're using, you know, chatbots to sort of curate knowledge and provide summaries for various things. So I think and I hope that those tools are really going to help us be more efficient, better physicians, and better able to use our cognitive capabilities to help and care for the patient rather than dealing with the absolute avalanche of information that we have to sort of sift through to get at the important stuff. So I hope ultimately it makes us more present clinicians. So I guess my answer for prediction and the normative question are similar because I tend to be an optimist. On one podcast I listen to, they ask every guest to give their P-doom, which is their probability of doom from AI whenever they talk to someone about AI. And I actually don't know what my P-doom is. Maybe it's around 50-50, which is still optimistic compared to a lot of the guests that I hear. So I tend to be pretty optimistic, including in medicine, because unlike other fields, medicine is a field where it is just so human and relational. You know, it's not something I feel like we're ever going to offload onto machines. Like, patients aren't going to want that. You know, I'm an oncologist. I spend a lot of time in relationship with my patients. You know, maybe not even treating their cancer per se, but that relationship is an important part of what we're doing too. And I think it's something that patients recognize and would never want to give up. They want to have a human, you know, humans in their care. So I tend to be pretty optimistic for medicine, as long as we're thoughtful about implementation, which I hope we can be. In terms of, you know, normative, again, I think the promise is, I think it should, these should be tools that are vetted, that are regulated, that are accessible, that are available to everyone. And again, to extend our ability and allow us to sort of work on the things that require a human, that care, that presence with the patients, and not as much time on documentation and on digging through the chart for that one piece of paper with the lab results that I need to make a decision. In terms of diagnostic and predictive tools, I think they are coming. And I just hope that, again, we use those as sort of human in the loop to help our understanding and to help maybe give us some different ways to think about things without totally replacing our own judgment.
Wonderful. So, Erica, this is a podcast about interdisciplinarity and the overlaps of science and the humanities. And I know a little bit about your history here, right? You did an ethics fellowship as part of your time at the University of Chicago, as well as a master's in data science when you came to the University of Rochester, as well as being a working clinician. That combination of clinical and technical and ethical expertise is a little unique. So I'm kind of interested about in how you connect all that up in your day-to-day work. And how do you think folks who have all those disciplinary backgrounds can work effectively in the context of medicine?
This is a really good question. And I will say it's only been in the last couple of years that I've sort of, you know, I'm sort of at peace with my journey and my career. For a long time, I tended to believe and I tended to internalize from others that I was, you know, flaky or aimless. I'm a very curious person. I am a person that just gets very interested in a lot of different things, and I tend to chase those things. And that is somewhat penalized in science and in medicine, where the clear messaging is you are supposed to have a clear focus and you develop expertise in that focus. And then you become an expert and you become nationally known and you become internationally known and you become the expert in that one thing. And I was told for a long time that the way I was doing science and the way I was doing my career was wrong. And I really believed that for a long time. It somehow didn't stop me from chasing all of these threads, but it was really painful to think of myself as not a very serious person. And so now when I go out and I talk to trainees, I tell this story because we're still telling this story to trainees about what they need to do. And it's very true that we need people with deep knowledge. Like, that is still the core. We need people to go out there and get deep, deep, deep expertise. And so they deeply understand the data and the field and the literature. That's still the cornerstone. But I also think there's space for people like me who have deep expertise, but I'm not funneling all of my effort into going as deep as I possibly can in one field. You know, I'm a clinician, I'm a researcher, I'm a data scientist. You know, I co-lead a technical team. I still try and keep in touch with my ethics background as much as I can. And the neat thing is all of those threads in the past, I would say 2 or 3 years, have really come together. And it's become this realization that I may not have the deep, deep knowledge that an expert would have in a lot of these things, but in general, I sort of know what I don't know. And I know how to find the people who do know. And I think that's really important too, to have those people that can sort of use those different lenses or talk from those different perspectives, even if they can't, you know everything from those perspectives. They know how to bring in the people. And so I used to call this sort of translator, but I think it's more than that. One of my mentors, Dr. Norton, calls it cultural broker. And I love that term. I've stolen it from her. And so there's space for people like me. And I want to say that to the people who told me otherwise, but especially to the trainees. You know, if that's your path, it's really fun. I love what I do. And I sort of, this really suits how I think and I learn and how I interact with people. But it wasn't always easy to feel that way about those different threads. But I'm very happy to say they sort of come together. I'm aware of using all of those lenses in what I do. And that's really profoundly enriching for me.
So speaking of the work that you're doing, what are you working on next? What are your big projects? And what are the big questions or problems that you would like to answer and tackle using your training in oncology, data science, and ethics?
Yeah, so a lot of my work right now is in thinking through and implementing the data platform that I alluded to earlier. You know, this is a team of about 10 of us in the cancer center. I'm the clinical director. We have an executive director who has deep technical knowledge across a lot of different technical fields, and who's actually sort of the builder and the technical visionary of the team. But I think a lot about implementation and how we use this data platform, some of the things that we were talking about earlier. And then how do we build tools on top of that that fill a gap that physicians need or researchers need? And how do we do that with accountability, with fairness, with accessibility? Really thinking through some of those things of bringing these tools into the clinical space. So we have a number of those tools that, you know, we've gone in and we've kind of identified where people are missing information or where they could use these tools, and then trying to plug some of those gaps, while at the same time really thinking through how we assemble these data responsibly and how we steward that. You know, we want to be good stewards of that data because, again, it is so important. So I would say that's one of the more meaningful parts of my job right now. And then in terms of research, I'm really interested in understanding these large multimodal, you know, foundation models and how they might be used in places where we don't have a lot of clinical trial data. So going back to like data scarcity. So I'm a geriatric oncologist who treats only older adults with cancer, which is sort of a data desert. We don't have a lot of data about older adults. They're not included in clinical trials that form our evidentiary base. And so we're often cobbling together, you know, information to make decisions for the patients who are coming in to see me. And older adults are also very heterogeneous. They're like the opposite of airplanes. They're all very different. And we get more different as we age in terms of the health conditions that we have, how we're functioning in our day-to-day lives. Like every 80-year-old is very different. You can't just, you know, say they all look the same. So one of the things that really interests me, there's not enough geriatricians out there. There's not enough of us. And there's a growing population, obviously, of older adults. So again, how can we use these tools to sort of extend a geriatrician or sort of that understanding, I think is a question I'm really interested in. I don't know if it'll work for the reasons we've talked about, but it's something I'd like to test. And so one example is frailty. So frailty is a syndrome. And I always say it's kind of like one of those things, if you're a geriatrician, you know it if you see it. But it's actually quite difficult to define because it's a final common pathway for a number of different situations. There's not one way to get to frailty, but once you get to frailty, it's sort of an emergent property, if you will, and it has its own prognostic significance. But we haven't come up with a good way, even with vast amounts of real-world data, we haven't come up with a good way to identify it with discrete data, for example. You know, we take a whole bunch of granular data about the patient. We can't really predict who's frail compared to, say, a trained geriatrician assessment. So one of the things I find really interesting is, could a multimodal model take a bunch of information from the chart, read the notes, look at the labs, look at the images, like the muscle mass on the images, for example, you know, and could those models do any better at lining up with how geriatricians think about frailty? That would be a very powerful tool if we had it. So it's something that's kind of fascinating me and that I think is a next area of research. But there's a lot of problems there in terms of alignment with what a geriatrician would think or do. What happens if the model mischaracterizes frailty? All sorts of ethical issues, which I would also love to get into. But that's where my work is going right now.
Wonderful. So Erica, this has been such a rich conversation, and I'm really glad that you are willing to join us today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.